other funds as monopoly money, and forgetting that other funds often originate from real money somewhere out there. And we would just like to have that identified, and this is particularly a concern, I think, that Senator Whitsitt and I have had, and I think the rest of the members probably too, but so we would ask them, and any of your help you can provide us with that would be appreciated.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I'll work with the agency to get you that information.
Yeah. Okay. Can we get started then, Mr. Secretary? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a real pleasure to be here today. I'll be here with you. Well, for the record, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State, and I'll be here with you today and then next week while we walk through the budget, and I'll be introducing to you my division directors who will walk through specific parts of the budget. But I wanted to just talk a little bit about what we've been about for the last couple of years. In recent years, we've taken a really good hard look at our budget to make sure that the appropriate source was paying for the various divisions of our agency, which speaks to other funds and various fee funds. And to that end, we focused on decreasing our dependence on general fund, and I'm proud to report that we've succeeded in doing so. Basically, been able to succeed in doing that by focusing really on efficiency in the operation of our agency. What I hope that you will take away from our testimony overall in the next couple of days is how well we've done managing our budget, controlling costs, refining programs and services for efficiency, and implementing technology that makes a difference to our customers. We have a real story to tell about how some of our divisions have faced staffing cutbacks and reduced budgets, but have continued to provide great service to the public by maximizing their use of new technologies. Our strategic goal that the agency adopted a number of years ago has been to invest in technology so that we could put more of our information and services online so that the public can get access to them very easily. Now, I just really hope that my years as Secretary of State can be remembered as a time when this agency streamlined operations to match the needs of Oregonians using the best available 21st century technology really to solve problems and provide the public good access. Let me just give you a couple of examples. Look at our Archives Division. The Archives Division gives stellar public service using technology to, number one, publish exhibits, offer web-based training applications, and they've added more than 500,000 names to our online genealogical names index. Those are the kind of service that Archives is able to do through technology. You can really see a similar success in the Business Services Division, where we've saved money on paper and postage by using our website to post contracting opportunities. Prospective bidders can now log on to our website and view solicitations, register online, and download the documents they need, saving obviously time for everybody involved, but also saving money and paper and postage. Likewise, the Corporations Division has become a leader in online business, or what's sometimes called e-government services. The division has seen a 21% decrease in staffing since 95-97, that biennium. But despite that fact, it handles an ever-growing number of business registrations and services by using technology to automate public records requests and using technology for transaction processing. Now, prior to making the Corporation Division services available online, the public requested and used less than one-tenth of the public records information that they use today. So we've had a significant increase in public use of the records in the Corporations Division because of the technology we've been able to install. All of you are familiar with our Elections Division. And our Elections Division has really just completed a pretty incredible year where technology was the only way to meet the mandates given that division by both the federal and the state legislatures. Our centralized voter registration database, OCVR, which came through a mandate in the Federal Help America Vote Act, was in use for the May 2006 primary and was fully functional by the time the November election came around. Elections, working with our Information Services Division, went on to create ORSTAR, which is the campaign finance database that was mandated by the last legislative session, that really is just one part of a much larger elections business system that's still being developed. But both OCVR and ORSTAR, I'm very proud to say, were completed on time, completed on budget, and I have to say that it really was a pretty amazing feat to accomplish that during a very, very, very busy election cycle. Every election cycle is busy, but, you know, when you're trying to do centralized voter registration and you're trying to do a new campaign finance database at the same time, it's challenging. Now, maybe I have the best division directors around. I don't know. Maybe I do. But I can tell you this. When faced with budget crunches or mandated staff cuts, these division directors just haven't thrown up their hands in despair and given up. They've used their expertise and creativity to search out new solutions, and in many cases, those solutions have been found in the use of high technology tools. And so we really, in many ways, lead the state in terms of providing lots of our services through technology. So as you hear them present their budgets, you'll get the details on how they've worked their magic in each of their various divisions. You'll see the conscious choices and strategies that have kept this agency moving forward, both in good times and in bad times. And we've really been on the leading edge of technology that allows us to serve the public and provide them with the information they need better and more cheaply than ever before. So I hope that you will see that we have been good stewards of the public trust and good stewards of the public's dollars. So I think at that point it would be appropriate for me to ask John Lindback to come forward from our Elections Division.
Sure.
Is that okay?
That'd be fine. Thank you.
John, you come on up. I wanted to just introduce you to John. Probably most of you know him, but we're celebrating sort of an anniversary today. This is his sixth-year anniversary with the Secretary of State. He started in March of 2001. Prior to that, he served for 6 years as the chief of staff for the lieutenant governor in Alaska, and the lieutenant governor in Alaska has the responsibility for elections in the state of Alaska. Now, I want to also point out that John is the president-elect of the National Association of State Election Directors, known as NASED. And that means he'll be president of the organization next year, and this is a major national association that's been very involved in all the implementation of the new federal legislation relating to Help America Vote Act. So it's great to have a national player on our state team. John.
I usually like to start my budget presentations by introducing whoever is with me, and today I have Tammy Dittweiler from my staff in the front row ready to assist me with looking up statutes or whatever. Tammy was also one of our principal staff members. in charge of development of the new OrStar system. I figured that we'd be receiving some questions about that today.
For the record, John.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you.
And she also has for years been our lead staff member on production and distribution of the state voters pamphlet. So she's a good person to bring with me to budget hearings. I thought I'd just give you briefly, remind you what the major responsibilities of the Elections Division are. We, of course, oversee the conduct of elections in Oregon. We enforce all the laws related to the issuance of ballots and counting of votes by counties. And we investigate all complaints received related to those issues, including cases related to signatures on ballot return envelopes that that don't match the signatures on the original voter registration cards. We enforce campaign finance laws and regulations, as you all know, since you're all involved with our office in that regard. We have about 1,100 state committees now, and with the new change in the law that took effect on January 1, about 200 local committees now file their campaign disclosure information with our office. We administer the state referendum and initiative process, which, of course, has no controversy with it whatsoever. So that sort of embroils us in an emotion and controversy every 2 years. We publish and distribute the state voters pamphlet, as I mentioned earlier. In 2006 election cycle, we published and distributed almost 5 million booklets statewide to Oregon households. A single volume for the primary, and once again, two volumes for the general election. And we also administer the Help America Vote Act. HAVA was adopted by Congress, as some of you may recall, as a reaction to what happened in Florida in 2000, placing very large responsibilities on states. And it is our division's responsibility to see that Oregon complies with the requirements of that act, including the requirements related to implementing a new centralized voter registration system and ensuring that voters with disabilities have the opportunity to vote privately and independently. And I'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. Four of the five state responsibilities that I just talked about, all except HAVA, are carried out by 15 people, all permanent positions, and that includes me. The federal responsibilities are carried out by three people, all thus far temporary duration positions. The Elections Division staff has been managed, I think, in a very sensible and clever way for many years, long before I got here. And when I first got here in 2001, you know, when you're new to a position, you sort of sit back and sort of evaluate how you think the place has been run, and sort of watch it for a year or so. And after I did that for a year, I decided that I better just not screw this up because it was already running fairly well. We have a whole series of duties that we do in the Elections Division. They're very cyclical. As I mentioned, a good example of this is that in July of even-numbered years, the entire staff stops everything else that we're doing, and we all deal with initiative petitions. And everybody on the staff is trained to deal with C&E issues. Everybody on the staff must be prepared and ready to answer the phone and help people deal with conduct of election issues. Everybody on our staff has to be prepared to do everything, because there are certain times of the cycle when you have to stop whatever your primary responsibility is and help out over here with whatever the immediate deadline we're facing is. And that is the way this division has been managed, so that the people of Oregon and you as the legislature get the best use for your dollar. If we had people just devoted to one thing, we'd, of course, need a much larger staff. And so I wanted to mention that to you. I always start out my budget presentations with this because I've tried really hard since I got here in 2001 not to screw up that scheme because I thought it was really smart. And I thought that everybody gets the best use of the dollar if it is managed in that way. Now, it has resulted in some questions from time to time about why do things work this way? Why do things work that way? How come I don't get fined for almost a year after I hear that I'm in violation of a C&E law? And my answer to that has always been, our first priority is to get the disclosure right, so that the public has the correct information in regards to what has been spent or what money has been collected in a campaign committee. So priority number one is to get the disclosure right. Fining is not priority number one. And so because of all those cyclical demands on the staff, sometimes we have to wait a while in order to, for example, get proposed penalty notices out the door and so on. If people want us to do things much faster, I'm fully open to discussing that in some regards, and that includes investigations. But, of course, what it means is we have to work the resources of our division in a different way in order to accomplish that.
Mr. Chair. One other thing that is one of those issues that you sort of don't ever hear talked about straight on, but it's always little kind of corner conversations, is on the level that rises to penalties, what your office is really looking for, a zip code with two numbers transposed that rises to the level of a penalty. Maybe you could help us try to understand where the consistency is, where the thresholds are, what the intention of the office is with respect to what constitutes an egregious failure to follow the rules, and what are Scrivener's errors, and how you separate the two?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I presume you're talking about C&E penalties.
When you talked about getting penalties out the door,
right.
I mean, people think they've done everything okay, and then one day arrives the dossier citing all the real and perceived problems, and I'm just trying to figure out, you said you have a personnel issue. For people in this building that are on the receiving end of your personnel problems, I'm just trying to figure out where are the lines? How are you making judgment calls about the severity of violations and your interactions?
Well, our penalties for C&E issues are all related to, and the size of the penalty are applied to a penalty matrix that's related to what was inadequate and how long it was inadequate and how much financial activity was not disclosed on a timely basis. So it's all related to if you had, let's say, $20,000 in campaign activity that was not disclosed for 3 months under the law, your penalty would be much more severe than if you had $50 of campaign disclosure or $50 of campaign activity that was not disclosed and was 3 days late. And so the penalty matrix has been set so that it's relational to the amount of activity and how late it is. Now, in regards to individual small items that you're referring to, a lot of those we send out exam letters to let you know that something was incorrect, even though the penalty may be very small, and we may not assess a penalty because it's less than $50. But we do that anyway to let you know what was incorrect so that it can be corrected, you know, the value of that, so that you or your treasurer can make sure that's corrected in future reports.
Senator Whitchin.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Could you discuss the cost-benefit ratio of sending a series of registered dossiers to my treasurer and to me over a period of time about that thick for a lack of a zip code for the Associated Oregon Industries, which is across the street from you? I mean, to me, as a business person, that is a very difficult thing for me to grasp, the importance of spending your time and your efforts on that sort of thing rather than really looking for campaign finance errors or omissions or purposeful problems. I don't know how many hours went into your staff sending that stuff to me. I can give you some idea of the hours of my staff sending it back. I believe it was something like a $9 fine at the end of the day, which obviously you don't have to pay. The entire thing was an exercise in futility. I mean, my stack is about that deep on this particular thing, and I don't know how deep yours is. What is the point?
Mr. Chair, Senator, what's it? Yeah, some of those things are minor. I agree with you. But we have laws and rules that are set for a purpose, and I'm always happy to discuss with the legislature if you want to change those laws and rules on what's to be reported, what's required, what's not. This Secretary of State and former Secretaries of State have taken a philosophy towards the enforcement of C&E laws that we try to make sure that every disclosure problem that we see is addressed. We try to put them in, treat them in a proper fashion. So, and that I don't think it's fair. It would be fair to argue that because we pay attention to the small things, that we don't pay attention to the large things. We've obviously had some very large and important cases in the past few years, and we deal with both. And if the legislature would like us to deal less on the minor side, I'm happy to discuss that, but it would take, you know, some changes in and a discussion with you about what you feel is important and what you feel isn't important. The secretaries through the years have taken an approach towards enforcement of C&E where make everything cut and dried. If it's late, it's late. And have mitigating circumstances that are narrow. And in that way, everybody is treated the same and is treated fairly. And it doesn't open up the secretary to charges that there are political motivations behind the enforcement. So, I'm sympathetic with comments that, gee, you know, I'm getting dinged for stuff that's really a tiny, tiny matter. But historically, the secretaries and the public have placed a high priority on proper disclosure in Oregon because that's all we have. We don't have limits on contributions. We don't have limits on expenditures. What we have is disclosure. And in a state where there are no limits and anything goes in regards to how much money is spent and for what, the philosophy here has been that disclosure and enforcement of disclosure is very, very important.
Follow up.
Thank you. I understand the concern about being at accuracy, but again, the cost-benefit ratio of spending that time to do something, you know, that actually, if it were that important, my staff would simply look up the zip code and fill it in. I mean, it seems to be a focus on sometimes on minutia, whereas I just don't see the purpose in it. I mean, I understand the idea of accuracy, but as Senator Johnson suggested, an inverted zip code number or whatever, I struggle with that.
I would have to confess that I struggle with it too, but my problem appears to have been something a little different from the previous folks. The omission of a state and or city, but the inclusion of the correct zip code number. Now, I submit that, and I did to your able staff, that with the zip code, you have the address. You know, the post office will have no problem delivering your registered mails, if that's what you wish to send, you know, to that zip code, or anyone, you know, will have no problem running down that person if there's something that needs to be run down. But nevertheless, it resulted in one of those infamous letters that come out with the secretary's signature on it. And in relationship to this, I also have wondered a little bit as I go into the elections department on some occasions when one of these things has appeared. I've wondered whether the reaction of the staff to my inquiries is an indication of how really far back in the 19th century I am, or whether or not I should be trying out as a you know, stand-up comedian, because everybody in the background is laughing. Don't misunderstand me. I don't accuse them of that. It's gotten to be kind of a joke, because I do come in and we have some heated or discussions, and everybody is finding these entertaining, and I'm delighted to make you know, a little bit of light into the day of otherwise hardworking folks in the state capitol. So anything I can do to make you smile and in the elections division, I'm delighted with that, representing Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we all have our little things that we've had to deal with, and we do get frustrated. But I do like to remind us that this isn't for necessarily our benefit or the Secretary of State's benefit. It's for the public's benefit to have this information. So we have to keep that in mind. And my big bone was always getting the exam letter saying your report was adequate. Personally, I thought my report was excellent. You know? So just being told it's adequate is just not very rewarding.
Maybe we could start a gold star system.
Yeah.
Mr. Secretary. Might I make just one comment?
Well, of course.
Which is that the legislature and the secretary's office have basically jointly made a series of decisions that have really, we don't have a lot of discretion, and that's by design. That's by the way you have adopted the law, to say we want to make sure that this law is enforced fairly and even-handedly. And we don't want to see it being used by one office holder or another to benefit one side or the other. And so the law has been written in a way that is pretty tight in terms of whether so where do you draw the line in response to Representative Whitsett? I understand your frustration. I used to be a candidate. I understand your frustration. But where do you draw the line on, well, it's okay to skip a zip code, but it's not okay to misreport the dollar amount? Or the legislature has not drawn that line for us. They've said, we don't have discretion. We just have to require that candidates fulfill their obligations of reporting under the C&E system. So I would say that if you want to provide us with discretion, we probably wouldn't want it. That sounds funny, but it's probably true, because we don't really want the discretion. We think you've done a very wise thing, which is to say, just be even-handed in your enforcement of the law, and we consider all the law to be what has to be enforced.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple of things that I'm curious about, and Mr. Secretary or John, either one, can feel free to answer. But kind of following up on Senator Johnson and Senator Whitsett, with regards to the timing of the notice to the candidates, I know that one of the things that, John, you just mentioned was that, you know, fines are not the highest priority. Getting the disclosure out and that sort of thing is, and that's very admirable. But I'm just wondering, with regards to the timing of the notice of the candidate, when there has been a long time that has elapsed, and the candidate doesn't know that they are in a violation, and then all of a sudden they get this notice that says they're in a violation, and the severity, you mentioned that the severity is based on the amount of time and the amount of the error. Is that taken into account in that assessment, or do you just say, well, it's been 5 months or it's been 8 months, and the candidate, but it was 8 months before the candidate was even notified of a violation. How are you rectifying that?
Well, the Representative Krummel, the notice is of a possible violation. You first get notice of that when you get your exam letter. And so if you get an exam letter and it says you need to clear this and this up, and you do that on a very timely basis, that's the best way to keep a penalty low. So the penalty is based not on when we send out a penalty notice to you, which is different from the exam letter. The penalty is based on the time between when the information was due and when it was actually submitted. So there shouldn't be a case where your fine is larger because the formal penalty notice didn't come out until some months later. It's not based on when that penalty notice comes out. It's based on when it was due and when the proper disclosure was made with our office.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
With regards to the exam letter, is it usually sent? Is there a specific time that it's sent within the time that the report is due?
Yeah, the statute requires us to get those exam letters out within 10 days.
Okay.
If you don't submit, under the old law, if you didn't submit a report at all, if you were late and it didn't arrive at that 5 p.m. deadline, we were required to have letters out to you within 24 hours saying we didn't get your report.
Okay. And then one more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to the lateness, when it's an issue, because I think in December we faced this because of weather and that sort of thing, but there was a technology failure on the part of the elections office. But candidates and former candidates were told that it didn't matter about the technology failure on the part of the elections division. The report was due, period. How do you rectify that, and what's your plan for then making sure that when there are technology issues within your office, that candidates that don't meet the deadline are not penalized?
Let me answer that question, Representative Krummel, because we have two different laws we're dealing with. The old one prior to January 1, 2007, and then the one we're operating under now. Under the old one, we had some issues with the way that law was written in regards to how to deal with those kinds of situations. I'm not sure we're talking about the same situation. I think the situation that you were referring to in your question was one where we had a statewide problem with DAS email, and the DAS email system was down for a number of days, and it was potentially affecting the ability of candidates under the old law who were subject to the electronic filing requirement. It could potentially affect their ability to get an email to us. And so we tried to get warning out very quickly to people that there was a problem with the DAS email, and that to make sure there is no question about whether or not you were timely to file a report with us in any way that you could in case you had trouble getting an email down. And we tried to get warning out to that. To people very quickly about that. As I recall, a number of people did that, and then the system got fixed, and we didn't end up having a problem. with any particular committee that I can remember in regards to timeliness. But it did raise some concerns, and I was sympathetic to those concerns. I don't know, you know, we didn't face the problem on how to deal with the situation where a committee was late and it was our fault under that situation. It never developed that far. Under the new law, the legislature wisely wrote into the new law that we are to consider as a mitigating circumstance for campaigns and candidates and treasurers the transition between the old system and the new system, and take that into account in the assessment of penalties. And I'll talk about ORSTAR a little bit later in our presentation, but we haven't seen anything, I haven't seen anything so far in that transition that would result in penalties for anybody. We have had a few issues here and there with people getting their stuff in on time. Some of them were all our fault. Some of them were not our fault, but it didn't matter. Everybody was trying to get in on time, and we are, as of now, assessing no penalties, and I don't intend to until we get through this transition period. So, and when that will be, I'm not sure, but we're probably 6 weeks away before we go back into sort of a regular enforcement mode of C&E, and we're through this transition period. So I'm not sure if that answered your question or not. But
well, if I may, Mr. Chair, it partially does, because I think in addition to the email failure that there was on the day that the reports were due, there was also a failure of your fax machine. And there was a lot of angst on many people's part as to how they were going to get those reports in, especially for people who live quite a ways away from the Capitol. And my concern is that if a report is late and is due to a technology failure, either through the web or through the fax machine being broken or whatever the case may be, then there ought to be some mitigation for that. The other thing is that I would assume that in the statute, within your rulemaking authority, you have the authority and probably the ability to actually plan and work out those types of details. And I would like to suggest that maybe that would be one thing that you would want to do. And if you don't have that authority in the statute, then let us know so that we can give you that authority, because I think that those are the kinds of things that, you know, we need to be on the lookout for, so that people are not, and that when they've attempted to send it in and haven't been able to. I know on my own part, whenever I fax it in, I always print myself a receipt so I can prove to you when I actually sent it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that just briefly?
Very briefly.
Okay. We do have, I believe, in statute something that helps us take care of these situations. It's called filing officer error. If we have a problem with our technology and it's our fault, in my view, that falls under filing officer error. It would be a mitigating circumstance.
I do understand the necessity of being very specific as far as these reports are concerned. I understand. I don't have the legal training that my good co-chair has, but I understand that the law needs to be very specific. And I understand also from many hours in graduate school about complex organizations, the way complex organizations deal with things is to take the line of the easiest line to doing that, which is to follow that to the letter. And I understand that we all have some types of observations with the Secretary of State's Elections Division, but I am I'm going to submit that it probably would take more time than the panel has to devote to the entire agency if we continue on this particular course, so we're going to move off of that and move on to more important agendas. Okay. Please.
Thank you. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about efficiencies in a small reorganization we accomplished in the past 2 years. I had a longtime manager of the Elections Division retire, and that provided an opportunity to do some reclassifications and change the way that the staff is constructed to help us address some issues. We reduced our managers from 4 to 3. In addition to my position as director, we now have 1 deputy director and a manager for our HAVA program. That 4th manager position was reclassified to a research analyst, a position that is responsible for oversight of our new ORSTAR system, campaign finance reporting system, and we'll also be implementing some quality assurance measures in our division. The reorganization included reclassifying a compliance specialist 2 position to an investigator. As some of you might recall, we asked during the past 2 regular legislative sessions to increase our staff to include an investigator position. The money was not forthcoming for us to do it. I decided in this opportunity to reclassify position this cycle because we've had a big increase in our investigations in our division and a need for more timely investigations, particularly of the petition process in Oregon. The lack of a full-time investigator was badly damaging our ability to investigate complaints related to the petition process in a timely way. And this reorganization helps us to be more efficient in trying to respond to our priorities. Overall, I would say the 2000 election cycle went very well in Oregon. We managed to conduct elections efficiently and without controversy, largely the result of an efficient working relationship between our office and county clerks, and frankly, the absence of any razor-thin election outcomes around the state. I think we've all learned that any time you have a very tight outcome, that you're headed for controversy. We did, as usual, have a few recounts during the cycle, and they all went well, confirming that county tally machines statewide worked like they should and that counties followed the proper procedures when processing ballots. In terms of our printing and distribution of the voters' pamphlet, I would say that we had a couple of rocky spots with the voters' pamphlet in the past cycle. Given the complexities of producing 5 million booklets, including 23 versions of the candidate booklets, I guess I should feel grateful that we don't have more problems than we do. We contract with a company to publish and distribute the booklet, which includes making sure that all the appropriate booklets get to the appropriate post offices around the state. We had an option to renew that contract for 1 more cycle, but we have decided not to do that and to go out to an RFP for a new contract. We had a distribution problem in the primary and the general election that Representative Crummell is familiar with that didn't affect a great number of voters, but it was troublesome enough that we decided that it was probably a good time to see if a new contract might be in the best interests of the state. It was one of those situations where there's an apartment complex, a large one, right on the border between Clackamas and Washington County. They're supposed to receive Clackamas pamphlets. In the primary, they received Washington County pamphlets. We called and alerted the contractor to the problem. They went and got the right pamphlets to the right folks, and then proceeded in the general election to make the same mistake again, which, of course, got the people in the apartment complex upset, got me upset, got Representative Crummell upset, got a lot of people upset, and we decided that it's time. Let's go out for this contract again and review it.
I think you guys do an extraordinary job with the voters' pamphlet, and I recall during my duration in the legislature listening to the secretary explain cost savings. really squeezing every nickel of value, changing the weight of the paper, the margins. I think you have been extraordinarily innovative in keeping a beloved Oregon institution available to voters. I want to turn to something a little bit more serious in the elections piece of this, and that is last night Senator Woodsit and I and others were in a very sobering meeting talking about the failure of the reauthorization of the Safe Rural Schools and the potential insolvency of some counties. The Secretary's old area down in Douglas County that has a 69% reliance on that money in their general fund, and they were actually talking about the potential insolvency of some counties. What plans or processes are in effect in your discussions with the counties in case there is insolvency for the conduct of elections in those counties? And I know that given the vicissitudes of the election cycles, your general fund fluctuates. So could you talk a little bit about what planning is in place if there is such a severe cutback or insolvency in some of the counties that they're no longer able to discharge their election functions?
I wish I could tell you that we had plans in place. We do not. I have been, this issue has come up in a couple of meetings recently with county clerks, and where they've said to me, are you prepared to come in and run our elections? And I said, no, we're not. Under state law, conducting the elections, the issuance of ballots and the counting of votes is a county responsibility. It's not a state responsibility, and if that relationship is going to change, there's a statutory issue and there's a practical issue about how we would do that. Obviously, given all the responsibilities of our office, and the functions that we do are very different. We don't issue ballots and count votes. You know, we're not. My staff isn't experts on how to run ballots through a tally machine. This is one of those functions where, if some county was to say, sorry, we're not going to do it, I have to be frank with you here. We're not prepared at 10 o'clock this morning to tell you just exactly how we deal with that.
Colleagues, I would just share that the counties that we're talking about right now are Josephine, Curry, and Wheeler. And while particularly in Wheeler, there's not a dense population, I think the counties in their presentation were not being overly alarmist in describing a very serious situation. And I think as we get ready to work on this budget, that we might be mindful of the fact that there could be extraordinary pressures on the Secretary's office to assure the conduct of fair and appropriate elections in some really extraordinary circumstances, and it just might be something that we give some thought to.
Yes, Representative Galizio.
Well, that very important question. I'm glad you asked that. So, just kind of throwing it out there. I mean, Senator Johnson, are you aware of if there could be statutory changes that can be made that might allow in an emergency situation? Some kind of funding or something along those lines. Are you aware? Is there anything that...
I'm not. I would just share with you, and I think the Secretary and Mr. Lindbeck can back this up, in one of the substantive committees that I serve on, there was a question of what do you do in extraordinary emergency circumstances. Tillamook County just happened to be underwater. I mean, literally underwater during the last election. And there were some extraordinary steps that were taken to deputize law enforcement to be able to go out and collect ballots and things like that. When we discussed those issues in the committee, because of the high sensitivity around the perception and the reality of a fair electoral process, there was much more controversy than I think one could have anticipated. This seemed like a relatively benign bill, and it sparked quite a bit of interest. And the reason that I'm belaboring this morning is that I think in preparation for the fact that we may have some counties unable to conduct business as usual, that it is incumbent upon this entire body to start thinking about what happens. And the counties have laid out a potential plan that they unveiled last night to formalize the relationship between the state and the counties to discuss some of these possible extraordinary outcomes. But I think it's a unique responsibility that falls to the Secretary of State's office. And at the point that we erode or corrode people's belief in a fair election, we will have done enormous damage. And so of all the things that concern me with respect to a pending fiscal crisis in some of the counties, I think in my own worldview, the elections rise right to the top. And I just offer that for consideration as we prepare to look at this budget, and particularly in the elections division. And with that, Mr. Chair, I need to excuse myself for a commitment.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Appreciate your comments, and see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Since Mr. Lindbeck mentioned the situation in Wilsonville, I would like to publicly thank him. In the general election, I did get on the phone with him, and he was very responsive, said they would get new voter pamphlets out that day, and they did. And I asked the people that were complaining to me to please let me know, and they let me know that they had gotten their new pamphlets, and so I appreciate the speed with which you reacted to that situation.
Thank you, Representative. I think that's very good of you to make that comment. And certainly, in spite of all of the sometimes difference of opinions that I have with the Elections Division, I have never found the staff there anything but helpful. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah. And Representative Crummell should be recognized for the fact that with the both different voter pamphlet books, he won, you know, both of them. In other words,
yeah. Regardless, he was successful with the class, you know. So I have to. It's very impressive. Yeah.
Oh, we actually find it very helpful when representatives call and alert us to a problem in your district. That's, you know. It's best not to assume that we've already heard, but in this case we have.
And I was probably a little snippy and shouldn't have been when I called.
I can't imagine you doing that. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the county situation again, because I think this is, yeah. We've spent a good deal of time talking about how you deal with us, and I don't want this to be a bitch session, and we'll just let that go. I'm very concerned about this county situation, a lot more than I think other people are, because my county, of course, is affected by it. I'm a half an hour from now, maybe talking to Senator Wyden's chief of staff about the issue again. What is do you know what your constitutional requirement is as far as elections are concerned in the state? If a county were to dissolve, not just not to function, but dissolve, if Kerr County says, we no longer exist, do you have a constitutional requirement to run the elections there as a state agency?
Not that I'm aware of, but I would like to confer with the Attorney General's office about that to help me figure that out. I mean, my understanding has been the responsibilities have always been very specific. Counties issue ballots and count votes. We oversee that process to the extent that we enforce the laws that they're required to follow when they do that. I've not, in my roaming around the Constitution and the statutes for 6 years, seen anything that says that if a county decides it's not going to do it, that responsibility automatically falls to us.
Follow up,
please.
When Oregon became a state, I believe parts of the state were not at that time counties, or there were huge counties in eastern Oregon, but I think parts of the state were not counties or people living there. We have a responsibility not only for local elections, state elections, but responsibility for federal elections. This could become a really sticky situation very, very quickly. We can't conduct elections under equal protection. I imagine there would be a lawsuit filed by citizens of those counties saying we have a right to vote, we can't vote. And so would you look at this for us and bring it back to us?
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a very important issue. Counties are now trapped, some of these counties are. Curry County has a mill rate very low, about 50 cents per thousand. but ballot measure 50 boxes them. You can probably do some special levies for public safety, probably do one for libraries if they wanted to. I don't know if they could do one for elections, but I would like to find that out too. That would not be prevented by ballot measure 50.
We do, Senator Biggs, have a tool available to us now that we have not had in the past, and that is our centralized voter registration system. So if a county did dissolve under the worst case scenario, we do know who all those voters are and where they live and their addresses and so on. But there's a lot of statutory issues here. For example, I'll give you just one. When your ballot is returned to the county clerk and the county clerk alone has the authority to decide that your signature on your ballot return envelope matches the signature on your voter registration card. We do not have that authority. And I presume that that was made historically because it was decided that the, you know, county clerks know their voters better than somebody in Salem. And so that's just one example of a whole, I think, myriad of issues that would have to be addressed if we're going to go down the path and discussion of the state moving in to take over the actual conduct of an election in a county.
Sorry, Richard.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. First, a question for Mr. Lindbeck. The Oregon Centralized Voter Registration System apparently is funded by the counties up to about $450,000 a year. Following along with this line of thought, that source of funding to some extent may dry up as a result of this. So do you have a contingency for that?
Well, the support, the total support for the centralized voter registration system is approximately $1 million a year, just a little shy of that. The counties, as you mentioned, pay half, and the state is paying half through Help America Vote Act funds. Currently, and to the extent that there was a problem with county payments, I guess our proposal would be to come in and, you know, absorb that through our Help America Vote Act funding, which of course isn't going to last forever. We have done some projections under our current spending that show that our Help America Vote Act funds are going to be here through. Three or four more budget cycles at least, and there is also talk in Congress about further legislation and fully funding the Help America Vote Act because they never funded year three. So I don't think it presents an emergency situation in terms of funding if some counties should dissolve, but it does present some long-term issues to talk about. Senator Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the Secretary. What happens if this Curry County dissolves? Is there a statutory process where that county is reassigned to another local entity, or does it just sit there, and what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witt says, I have no idea. And I think you have raised, this committee has raised a very important issue that I'm very painfully aware of because I live in, my home is in Coos County. I own timberland in Curry County. I'm certainly aware of the problems with ONC funding, but I don't know the answer to your specific question.
I assume that the Lexis Division will be pursuing a AG opinion on this topic forthwith.
We'd be glad to do that.
I mean, I think we've raised one of the really troublesome questions, this morning here, and there may not be some statutory way around this at present. There may be, but I am sure that the folks in Wheeler County, which has been mentioned as one of the endangered species here, think their vote is just as important as the people in Washington County or Marion County or wherever, sort of thing. So probably not part of the budget discussion as such, but certainly a critical issue for us, and I would appreciate anything you can find out. If you can share it back with the committee when you find it, it would be appreciated.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I personally have been aware of the ONC crisis, but I really hadn't thought about it in relation to the elections issue. So I really appreciate this committee raising those questions, and it will inspire us to really do some real checking with the Attorney General and see what possible solutions there might be.
Senator Bates. Yeah, Mr. Chair, when you have that discussion might also ask the question, under Oregon constitutional law, what is a county required to do as its first priority? Can counties build roads? Some have police departments. Some have social services. Some take part to a degree in their schools. But my hunch is they're required only to do one thing, and that's to make sure their citizens have the right to vote. And I would not be surprised to find that that is their one and only primary constitutional requirement. They're not required to build roads, have schools, do social services. I bet they are required to conduct elections, but I don't know for sure. And it would be very interesting to find that out, that if a county with a very low mill rate like Curry has enough money to run the elections, that's all they do as a county. Everything else stops existing. Those are going to be very interesting to find out, because we are facing that.
That would be my personal priority for them, Senator Payne.
But it might be the priority for those citizens, too. Right. I mean, to tell a citizen you can't vote in a national election because you're in Curry County. That might get Dateline down here.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oregon, back on the map again. Thank you. Might get Boonesbury in. Oh, yeah, we'd be doing
very good. Okay. How much more do you have to go through?
I can be as fast or as slow as you want. If you want me to be fast, I'll dig in here and try to get through this in about 10 minutes.
Well, let's see. We've got 15, and I think we were supposed to have archives up this morning, too.
We can. It was kind of however
it plays out, sort of thing. And we will. We've got about 15 minutes, and if you can finish it up in 15 minutes, I'd appreciate it. Representative Crummel, you've got that. I've got a comment look on your face.
Well, since you opened the door, Mr. Chair, I would just, in adding on to what Senator Bates was talking about, I would just ask the Secretary, or John, if when they're discussing this with the AG's office, if there is something in the statutes or in the Constitution with regards to dissolution of a county and how that occurs. And there may not be anything. I don't know. I know for creation of a county, it takes an act of the legislature.
Okay.
We will, Chair will also pursue this with LC.
Thank you.
Good idea.
Look at it from our end, but the thing is whether we will have some obligations to with that. So try to get all of the certified smart people immediately to work on this so that we don't encounter problems or something like that. Thank you. Please, John.
Okay. All right. The next subject I'd like to discuss with you is our compliance with the Help America Vote Act and our issues with one of the special challenges of that act, and that's the requirement related to voters with disabilities. Each state faced two big deadlines on January 1, 2006. One we've already talked about, which was implementation of the centralized voter registration system. The other was that each state was required to make sure that every voter with a disability was provided the opportunity to vote privately and independently. Our new centralized voter registration system was in place in a timely fashion, but we ran into some contractual problems with our vendor for equipment that we were going to purchase for voters with disabilities. We were not able to reach a final agreement with that vendor for the purchase of that equipment. And so we were staring at our primary election in 2006 out of compliance, which, of course, was a major concern. We had some discussions with the U.S. Department of Justice which enforces federal legislation relating to voting rights. And they suggested that we look at a system that allows voters with disabilities to use the telephone as their voting device and to have them come into the county elections office and use a setup there. And we did go ahead and do that. Frankly, it was okay. We had some voters use it who were thrilled that for the first time, as a blind voter, for example, that they could vote privately and independently without help from someone else. But we also implemented something else just to see how it would work, and we're referring to that as the HTML ballot. And what that is it's a ballot coded in HTML language that can be read by assistive technology used by voters who are blind or who have other kinds of disabilities, and it allows them to vote on their home computers. And so we send them a ballot, the quote-unquote HTML ballot, either through the email or on disk. They're able to pull that up on their machine. It actually converts it, in cases where necessary, to an audio ballot so that they can listen to it. And they're able to vote that ballot, print it out, put it in their regular ballot return envelope, return it to their county elections office, and the county elections office, when receiving it, duplicates that ballot on a regular ballot through the sort of normal duplication process that they have. And it turned out to be very popular. They liked it because they could vote on technology that they were familiar with, and they could vote on it at home. We had very low usage of the machines in the elections offices in the general election, and actually had more people using the HTML ballot. As a result, our disabilities community has come to us and said, bag this other stuff, don't worry about this equipment, we like the HTML ballot, use that as your permanent solution to comply with HABA. And so that is our intent at this point to move forward. Now, it does involve an investment of money in that we need to purchase computers, laptops for county elections offices for those voters that may not have a computer at home. And so these laptops would be equipped with this assistive technology, and voters who don't have a computer at home could use those. They need to be portable enough so that under our law that allows a voter with a disability to call the county and ask for assistance, the county could actually take one to a voter in their home and use it. I've had a brief conversation with the head of the voting rights section at USDOJ, telling them that this is our plan and that we intend to write them a letter and tell them that this is our plan. Our history of dealing with them, they're an interesting agency, is you tell them things, they never respond, and as long as you don't hear, that's good news. And so my expectation is that we will write them a letter saying, here is our permanent solution for compliance with the disability sections of HABA. Our disabilities community will write supportive letters. We'll get supportive letters from the national disabilities community, and so my prediction is that we won't hear from USDOJ and everything will be just fine, and that we will have arrived at a solution in Oregon that is more cost-efficient and more popular with our voters with disabilities, and that they get to vote at home just like all of us do, and they'll be happy. So that is our plan on moving forward. Our lawsuit with the company that we couldn't reach an agreement with was settled before Christmas, and we settled with them for about $200,000 in vote tally equipment that they produce that many of our counties already use. And so the counties will be receiving that equipment as part of a separate program under HABA in which we are allocating money to counties to purchase new vote tally equipment. So that's the long and short story about compliance with HABA. Finally, our biggest challenge of the year, I would say, was implementation of the new ORSTAR system. The responsibility layered on top of a busy election year. It was probably the most stressful thing I've done in 6 years, and this is a pretty stressful job, so that's really saying something. rollout of the new system has gone well, but that doesn't mean it hasn't had its challenges. We've had some issues on our end. Vendors that some of you work with have had issues on their end. Everybody's had issues, and I would say overall, though, that it's pretty much gone like we expected. And sort of parallel the centralized voter registration system, in that you always have this period of time in which you're working out bugs that no matter how much testing you do, you didn't anticipate. Some of them are ours, some of them are not ours, but like I said earlier, everybody, all parties involved in this, as far as I can tell, are trying to do the right thing. We're not assessing penalties, don't intend to assess penalties. Whether it's your vendor's fault or our fault or whatever, as long as we can tell that people are trying to do the right thing, and I haven't seen a single case of somebody not trying to do the right thing. So our staff is working as effectively as a help desk. Everybody's prepared to help people that either call into the office or come into the office. We've got almost 800 users. We've had almost 26,000 transactions filed successfully on the system. Each day is getting a little smoother and a little smoother, and I expect that in about 6 weeks we're going to have this thing working so that we can switch back into enforcement mode.
Along those lines, do you have a lady named Connie that works on that system?
Connie. No, we have Tammy.
maybe it was Tammy, but my treasurer has called on a couple of different occasions and maybe has talked with Tammy. Anyway, whoever it is that she's been talking to, she loves her because she's been very helpful. She's very knowledgeable of the system. She knows and she knows it kind of inside out. And I just, again, want to pass along that note to
you. Thank you.
Sounds like Tammy to me.
It could be Candy. We have a Candy. We have a Carla.
I'll have to ask her.
They're all knowledgeable.
Can we move on?
Senator Whitson.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I think, Mr. Lindman, that measure of the filer trying to do the right thing is a good measure to keep in mind all the way through the system. I did have a question in LFO's analysis of the budget. They said there is a fairly large increase in risk management premium being charged by the Department of Administrative Services to the Election Division. Could you explain that, please?
Risk management is what the assessment we pay help us cope with all the legal costs of our division. We get sued a lot. You know, I'm one of their best customers, and you know, I go home at night and my wife says, "Have you been sued today?" And I go, "No, not today, but expect to be sued tomorrow." There's lawsuits. I mean, we got sued by a guy who didn't, you know, who insisted that we had to accept old antique coins from him for his filing fee. We got sued over issues relating to the initiative process. We get sued over everything. And my division gets to pay the bill. And we have extensive legal costs. I would say it's probably one of the biggest financial burdens on the elections division are our legal costs. And our risk assessment is an assessment we pay to the DAS. And they will take on some of those legal costs in some of those big cases. A good example is Measure 47. You remember that one? Adopted by the voters. And we looked at it, and it has a section in it that says that it doesn't become operational until there are limits in place written by the sponsors. And so we said, okay, it's not going to be operational until there are limits in the Constitution, and the sponsors have sued us, as we expected. The costs are substantial. We expect it to be over $100,000, but that is a case where risk has picked it up and they are paying those costs. So I do get something for the risk assessment that we pay, but the amount that we pay, I assume, is related to the amount of legal activity.
Right. Thank you.
All right.
Chair, we're going to run out of time here, and I think some of us have a few more questions. Do you, would you entertain us allowing them to come back on our next day and have a little more of a discussion?
I would invite them back, yes.
Thank you. This is the most important part, I think, of the Secretary of State's office, and really a good conversation. I'd like to continue if we could.
Well, we've already demonstrated this morning, even with some lightness taking place, that there's some important issues that come up here. So.
Thank you.
Representative Polizia.
Would it be possible, I was really interested in the accessible, the HTML ballot. Would it be possible, can you just sort of write up exactly how that works?
Yes.
And then
I have a write-up I can get to.
And then is there any way that we can sort of obtain that electronically, or just kind of see how it would work, or something like that?
We could
get a demo copy.
Well, yeah, I'm really interested in.
We could provide a demonstration for you if you'd like. Sure.
Well, I don't want to do the whole, for the whole committee, but I just would be really curious how that works. And then, can I have a follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Any other states doing anything like that?
Interestingly enough, no. But boy, are they interested! They're very, very interested, and. Particularly Washington, because 36 of their 39 counties have now switched to all vote by mail. And people really want to vote at home. That's what they really want. I'll give you the write-up I've been showing to some of my fellow directors in my association. They're all very, very interested in it.
Just one comment I have to say, just as you're talking about vote by mail, in addition to receiving an Oregon-based newspaper, I also get the New York Times, and it never fails. Usually the letters to the editor are from people in New York or Chicago or Los Angeles or Miami, but every time the discussion about election fraud comes up, there's always at least one letter to the editor from somebody in Medford or something that says, why don't you do vote by mail? We have the greatest system. I don't know what's the matter with the rest of the United States, and it's very gratifying. And
we seem to be at a pretty convenient break point, if it's convenient for you where you're at right now.
All right.
We'll stop at that point and see you tomorrow for a few more questions. And there's some agent, of course, to get that going.
Tomorrow? Are we meeting tomorrow?
No. we'll meet Monday.
Thank you.
No cardiac arrests here at this point. Thank you very much.